Welcome to Yoga Talk, the Yoga International podcast. I'm your host, Kat Hegberg. I'm the editor of Yoga International.
And I am Kyle Rebar, the AV director of Yoga International.
And today, Kyle and I are joined by Sierra Hollister. Welcome, Sierra.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. We just finished filming some classes, some great Kundalini classes with Sierra, and we're really excited to release those to you on yogainternational.com really soon. So if those aren't already up, they will be soon. So definitely keep checking our classes page. And Sierra, before we delve too much into the Kundalini questions, I wanted to ask you if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your practice and what it is you do.
Well, I consider myself a yoga universalist in that I really love all yoga. So I'm not out to have people drink Kundalini Kool-Aid or you know, really pick one path. Personally, I practice a lot of different styles and see the value in a multi-path practice. With that said, Kundalini is my passion. It's my big heart yoga. And I do Kundalini every day.
So how did you get started practicing yoga, Sierra? Did you start with Kundalini or another style?
I actually started with another style. And while I had done some yoga out of books and had some experiences as a teenager, I would say my first true class was in my early 20s. It was really a power yoga style, and it was perfect because at that point in my life, I really had a machismo about my health and my fitness, and so I really kind of needed to get my ass kicked to be interested in yoga in a bigger way. So that was really my first big yoga experience, and that happened on the West Coast. And when I was back on the East Coast, I tried to replicate that, and I couldn't find anything like it. But in my search, I stumbled into a Kundalini ashram.
Wow.
Yeah.
From a power class stumbling into an ashram.
Right? Yeah, and I was hooked on Kundalini immediately.
So I'll preface this by saying that I'm a yoga fledgling, let's say. I've been practicing for about a year, and I've been, you know, working for the Himalayan Institute and YI for close to 4 years now. But my very first encounter with anything remotely related to Kundalini was at the Sedona Yoga Festival. And our crew was taking a very soft, very subtle, I think it was called the Holy Flow.
And Holy Yoga.
Holy Yoga. That's it. And through the divider wall, suddenly came this loud industrial noise. It kind of sounded like grinding metal. And like loud drones and people chanting, lots of people chanting very, very loud. And I'm like, whoa, you know, what's going on over there?
Right.
And I asked the doorman later, and he simply responded,
Kundalini.
So is any of that at all related to like proper Kundalini yoga?
Oh, absolutely. Kundalini is such a big, big, big practice. It's just massive. It's like a ocean, really. So there are kriyas that are really vigorous with chanting and heavy breathing and literally kriyas where we lift ourselves off the floor and drop ourselves back on the floor repeatedly, all the way to kriyas that are so gentle and so subtle that the challenge is your feet falling asleep and everything in between. It's really a very big practice. So my advice to people is, you know, if you really want to get a sense of Kundalini, do it at least a dozen times. Mm. And I would do it with a few different instructors, because while I believe that all of the instructors are doing their best to present the full spectrum of the practice. We're all only human, and we all have aspects of this big practice that we gravitate towards. So one instructor may really be so enchanted with the pranayama that it's a very pranayama heavy practice. And yet another instructor like myself, I tend to really love the physical practices. And another teacher could be all about the chanting, and it's all valid.
So to kind of back up a little bit for our listeners who might not be super familiar with Kundalini yoga and might be thinking, wait, what are we talking about? Do you have like an elevator definition or an elevator story if someone were to stop you and say, hey, Sierra, what is Kundalini yoga? What is the style you teach?
I would say Kundalini yoga is the yoga of awareness. It is a powerful, dynamic technology that is all about giving you the experience of your soul. It's about what you feel in your heart, the energy that you move. It is not the practice for somebody who wants, I mean, they're all about what they look like, right? It is a practice for moving the energy within, for transforming your energy, for uniting body, mind, and soul. And Kundalini yoga, the style that I teach is as Yogi Bhajan taught it, and he was a master of Kundalini yoga. He brought the practice to this country in 1969, and he's my teacher.
Yeah, you mentioned, or I think Kyle or Emily mentioned to me, Emily being our senior producer, who some of you might know from the podcast, that you'd studied directly with him, which is so very cool. And what was that like? Do you have any, not to put you on the spot, but do you have any stories or any experiences?
Well, he knew everything, and so that could be really intimidating. And while he was alive, I wasn't necessarily aware that I was fortunate. I was a little more intimidated.
Sure.
And there were definitely times where you could get called out when you least expected it. But it was, you know, when he died, I was just so heartbroken. And it was really at that point that I just realized, you know, I had had the grace to be in the presence of a master. And it was really another teacher from a different path, Chandra Om.
Oh, yeah.
She is Dharma Mitri, that lineage. When she learned that I had actually been able to study with Yogi Bhajan, she said, what a blessing on your soul. And really, she was the one that made me realize, wow, yeah.
So if you walk into a Kundalini class or click on a Kundalini video online, if someone is...
Or sit beside one.
Yes, well, yes.
One in Baser class.
Exactly. Or hear one from the wall divider at the Sedona Yoga Festival. It can look or sound very different than maybe a typical hatha class that we might be used to from our gyms or from our studios. And I think as a result that there can be a lot of misconceptions around Kundalini yoga. Are there any that you hear regularly and that you want to address and maybe kind of debunk any myths about Kundalini?
You know, back in the day, I really heard that a lot more. For example, when I came to Asheville, North Carolina from Washington, D.C., from the ashram in D.C., when I arrived in Asheville, people were afraid of Kundalini. And that's just no longer the case. I haven't encountered that in more than 20 years. There are definitely people that feel a little self-conscious about trying it, maybe because depending on which sequence you're doing or which meditation, there can be a lot of chanting. But whether it's Kundalini or Bhakti, everybody starts somewhere, so you can't get really super hung up in it, and you don't want to be self-conscious. You just want to give it a shot, give it a whirl. Kundalini is just so profound, I think, for moving the energy. And again, my reason for practicing yoga is not an exercise for me. It's not about a physical fitness. It's really about awakening and moving into the kindest, most compassionate, most awake soul that I can be in this lifetime.
That's beautiful. That's a really great why I practice statement.
So on the topic of like a Kundalini practice, I noticed when we were filming your classes, you talked about doing 108 repetitions of certain things. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of 108 and different numerologies within a practice?
Yeah, well, 108 is a mala, of course, and we do 26 is another one, and 26 vertebrae. And 40 is sort of this classic world tradition, 40 days in the desert, 40 days to change a habit, 40 days for a breakthrough. Yeah.
We can link to it in the show notes too. I know we were talking about this yesterday and we found some cool articles that talked about the significant, like all of the big significances of 108, like in astronomy and in mathematics. And it's a pretty cool number.
It is a magical number. And of course, that's why there's 108 on a mala, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, universal consciousness.
That's really cool. The 26 I wasn't aware of with the 26 vertebrae. That's really awesome.
Yeah.
So another thing too, why do Kundalini practitioners wear white?
Oh, that's a good question.
White is, so number one, it's okay to show up to Kundalini not wearing white. It's not a rule. But wearing white is said to expand the aura, and it carries an energy that's really uplifting. It lifts the vibration up, and you really have to lift yourself up to wear white, right?
It's definitely, for me, white is always like a scary color to wear, so I could totally see that. It's funny because I think I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but I always tend to, in fact, I'm wearing black right now, I tend to gravitate toward black. And there was, at the Himalayan Institute where I used to live, there was a Kundalini retreat that was happening. And at the time, I had black hair, and it was like laundry day, so I was really just, I put on like a black sweatshirt, and I was wearing black leggings, black, just really everything, pretty much. And so I walked down to the cafeteria, and I got in line for dinner, and it was like a sea of everyone in white, and then there was me. And I was like, of all the days, yeah, but I could definitely see how that would, at least on my part, I know, take a little bit of bravery.
Yeah, and, you know, personally, when my children were smaller, I live on a farm, it just really wasn't super feasible for me to spend a lot of time in white. And as my children have grown and my life has shifted a little, and I've been able to wear white without using bleach, because nobody wants to do that, I've really found that it does elevate my consciousness. It's a great way to practice saucha, you know, the first niyama.
Yeah. So going back to the beginners, if someone has never tried Kundalini before, you had some really good tips about studying with different teachers and, you know, taking, I like that, 12 classes, you know, give it 12 classes. That's it. Do you have any resources in particular that you would guide a beginner or someone who's never taken a Kundalini class but is interested toward?
Well, online is the International Kundalini Yoga Teachers Association. And that is a great place to start to find a Kundalini teacher in your area. If you don't know off the top of your head where you could study, I would also tell people, hey, Yoga International, we've got some Kundalini videos to get you started. And with IKETA, the International Kundalini Yoga Teachers Association, not all teachers that are certified are necessarily on there because it does cost money. There is a membership fee. And so just because a teacher isn't on there doesn't mean that they're not a great teacher. But it's a great place to start if you want to get into a live class.
So back on the subject of Yoga International videos, we had a little bit of a conversation with the crew yesterday about waking up super early and practicing, to paraphrase, taking cold showers. Uh-huh. Everyone's like, whoa, why would you do that?
Right? Well, because it's phenomenally good for the body. Great for the body, gets the blood flowing, gets the circulation flowing. Pretty much everybody listening can at least harken back to one cold shower in their lives, right? And how awake and vital did you feel after that? It's pretty incredible. And if you have subjected yourself to a cold shower, you might as well follow it up right. with a 2.5 hour practice. I mean, why not?
You're not going back to bed after that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So how would you, so if you're taking an early morning cold shower, now that isn't like a direct translation of your like evening warm shower, or would you shower differently with a cold shower practice?
I do not always do the cold shower, so and I never want anybody to feel like any of this is a must, or it's all more technology for you to see if it feels beneficial for you. But a cold shower is more, it's more about body health, circulation of the blood to all the tissues, that energy and vitality, and it's less an opportunity to actually get clean, right? So a cold shower can be pretty brief, really just as a way to wake up. And then, you know, you could take a warmer shower later or bath or...
Although my hairstylist said that it's really good for my color if I wash my hair in cold water. So.
It's true. It makes your hair shiny.
Yeah.
So even if you're taking a warm shower or a lukewarm shower, you can follow it with that cold ending or even a cooler ending.
I think you touched on this a little before too, but how do you balance your practice with the demands of teenagers?
Yeah, so early morning sadhana, as in 4 a.m. sadhana, kind of went out the window when I started having teens. And so I'm pretty much a big believer in doing what you can do. And so there were long stretches where if I could meditate before the sun came up, sometimes literally right before the sun came up, I felt like that was a win and that counted. And certainly there have been days when for whatever reason, my practice was that afternoon. But yeah, you just have to be reasonable and work with what you have. And so if you can't get up and chant before the sun gets up, you know, work with what you can do. If if you can create 11 minutes while you're waiting for your water to boil for your tea in the morning, you know, make advantage of that time. Take a posture, sit and do a meditation. There's so many resources. And the best practice is the practice that you're going to be able to do again and want to do again. It just serves nobody to have this unwieldy thing that doesn't fit with your life and you dread.
So, Sierra, I heard that you are a runner, and Kyle and I are both runners too. Probably Kyle a little more than me, as he has on his half marathon t-shirt. I have definitely not ever run a half marathon. I'm like working on 5K territory. But I wanted to ask you if there were any practices in particular or any ways that your practice has helped your running, or even vice versa, if you had any tips for our fellow yogi runners out there.
So for the people that can't see me, I have entered the decade of the 50s. And for all you runners out there, the news is not really that great. You know, I love running. I completely and totally love running. And I have run mostly on, occasionally off, but mostly on for most of my life. And nowadays, I find so much of my yoga practice is really about combating the effects of running. For many, many years, I would say my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, I could run like a beast and do any yoga I wanted. But more and more, I find that my running, I'm tighter. My back is tighter. My legs are tighter. I pretty much have to take wheel pose every day because I'm afraid I'm going to lose it from my low back tightening from running, totally. Right? Yeah, so yoga is great for your running. Running is not so great for your yoga. That's the truth, yeah.
Well, I know I find that when I know that people have like different things that they say about doing yoga first or doing running, and I've kind of like experimented with both. And I know that if I do a yoga practice before I run, I feel so much better when I run.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And same thing with after too. Usually I don't always have time to do one before and after, but if I did, it definitely makes a difference.
Yeah. You know what I really love is a long run and then a yin practice.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, that's like decadent loveliness. Yeah. Love that.
So let's shift gears a little bit because I wanted to ask you about Light a Path, the nonprofit that you're involved with, which aims to bring yoga to those who might not otherwise have access to yoga. How did you become involved with it? And what is it that you do? And what is it that the organization does beyond what I just said?
So I'm so in love with this organization. Light a Path is a 501c3 nonprofit that was created by myself and five other yogis that I'd love to get a little shout out to now. Susan Kagan, Stephen Holsenbeck, Connie Cody, Lisa Sherman, and Chris Moon. Everybody has really worked so hard to create this platform for supporting personal, communal, ecological resilience by connecting service-minded yoga teachers, somatic therapists, and body workers to populations with limited access to no access to holistic resources. And our mission statement is actually connection creates resilience. Mm-hmm. So it's a massive umbrella, right? Connection creates resilience. We can really support any kind of somatic therapist, you know, yoga teacher, meditation teacher, acupuncture, sound therapy. We support the practitioners in serving the population they feel called to serve. At this juncture, we work with the incarcerated, we work with youth at risk, and we work with the unhoused, which more commonly are referred to as homeless, but the term unhoused offers a little more respect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was reading your blog, or the, I should say, the blog post, Inmates Talk About Yoga, and something that really stood out to me was, it's actually in Inmates Talk About Yoga 2, and JB first is talking about, you know, how he was a discharged Army Ranger and thought he had discipline, and then he started taking yoga, and he's talking about all the wonderful results he was having from this. But he also, the line that stood out to me a lot was, I do not care what others think of me or what I do, but I do care about people such as y'all, because y'all care about our health and understanding. And I was wondering, is that something that Light a Path has to face when working with at-risk communities and prison communities, stuff like preconceptions of masculinity? Because I can imagine that could be a really big hurdle to get around.
Sure.
In certain populations.
Sure. It's overall, the work is incredibly humbling. With youth at risk, for example, these are kids who quite often their home contains an abuser. You know, they don't have money, their home is falling down, and so they're traumatized, they are putting on a tough act, and they sidle in the yoga room, and little by little, week after week, they just unfold into these practices. And what is so humbling about the youth at risk, as well as the incarcerated, is how beautifully grateful they are for these practices. It's really an entirely different spectrum than studio yoga. I mean, I teach classes in a studio, and I love the people that come to my classes in the studio. I love them so much. But, you know, these kids that are at risk, or, you know, I teach in the women's correctional facility, they are just thirsty for these practices. And so often, this is the first time that anyone has showed up consistently for them with no agenda. I don't want anything from them. I just want to offer these postures, this breath, this way of talking to yourself and your mind, you know, the chance to meditate. And for so many of them, this is the first time anybody has shown up like that for them.
How do you vet your teachers or choose, because you can't just have anybody going into a room like
you
this.
You really can't, because the populations we're working with are really vulnerable. And when we have an application on our website, so anybody, whether it's a yoga teacher or you know, a sound therapist or an acupuncturist. And we have programs that aren't up and running yet with other somatic therapies that are, you know, we're trying to match up. Regardless, they fill out an application. They include all their certifications, their experience, as well as references. And we call the references, and we specifically ask the references. For example, if it's a yoga teacher and they want to work with youth at risk, we ask their references, how do you think that's going to go? And we do tell all of our teachers that unless they can give a year, that we'd like to use them more in a substitute basis, which works great for a lot of people. But again, these are populations where it's they're too vulnerable for a teacher to decide that it isn't in fact going to work out for them. So, you know, every now and then a young teacher will say, well, I want to try it for a few weeks. And we'll say, well, we'll let you sub a few classes, but you really need to make a commitment of at least a year to have your own class and have really impeccable references. And then, you know, with our, when we work in the schools run pretty exhaustive background checks on anybody that volunteers in the schools. And the same with the prison system. They run really exhaustive background checks to allow anybody into the prison system.
Do you have any general advice for other teachers who might be interested in working with vulnerable or underserved populations? Like where maybe they could get some additional training or particular things to keep in mind?
So there is the prison yoga project, Jamie Fox.
Yeah.
He offers trainings all the time. And there are so many great trainings out there for using yoga with trauma-sensitive populations. And I really advise at least some training, specifically with working with trauma-sensitive populations, because there's so many things that it may not occur to excellent yoga teachers of long standing, you know, just the simple telling people to close their eyes.
Right.
There are a lot of people who to close their eyes is really scary depending on their environment. And, you know, there's just a lot of things like that. So we're so fortunate nowadays that there are so many trauma and yoga, trauma sensitive trainings going on.
Yeah.
So, you know, checking with, I don't know if Yoga International has, you have some really excellent articles and scientific research on trauma and yoga. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
'Cause I've read that. So I would start with Yoga International and then from there, follow that trail. And pretty much any good-sized yoga studio is gonna be hosting trainings like that.
Yeah. Accessible yoga, too, is a really good resource. I was just talking to Jivana Heyman the other day, and they have their conferences that they do in, like, Hala Kuri and Matthew Sanford and some great leaders in the trauma-sensitive yoga world have workshops that they do through there. I know they have, like, their own trainings, too. So I would definitely recommend that as well.
Yeah.
And where can listeners go to find out more about Light a Path, or if they want to donate, or if they want to give back directly with Light a Path in some way?
Oh boy, would I love that. So Yoga International has a link on my bio, on the teacher bio, that will take you right to Light a Path. And otherwise, if you weren't going to go through that pathway, it's www.lightapath.org. And we are also on Facebook.
And we will link to both in the show notes. So if you're listening to this podcast via yogainternational.com, then you'll see that right in your show notes page. And if you're listening via iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice, you can go to yogainternational.com and you can type Yoga Talk in the search bar and this podcast should come right up. Otherwise, you could just go to lightapath.org.
Yay,
correct?
Yes. Right?
Yes. Great. Well, thank you so much, Sierra, for talking with Kyle and I today. That was definitely very enlightening. I learned a lot about Kundalini and a lot more about working with underserved populations as well. And again, we will link to Sierra's website and to Light a Path and to any of the resources that we mentioned in our show notes at yogainternational.com. And if you have any questions or topic suggestions or people you'd like us to interview, you can send those comments and requests to yogatalk@yogainternational.com.
And now our
intro.
Outro is going to be You in the Shimmering Dust by Air4Effect.